It's Tuesday, January 4th. Welcome to today's edition of my Daily Ag Life News Report podcast. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. Today's show, we start off with a special report from Taylor Chalstrom on the benefits of soil microbes during drought. Coming up, we also will be checking in with USDA Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack and the California Strawberry Commission. Stay tuned for today's show.
Soil health is directly related to the interaction or lack thereof between organisms in their environment in a soil ecosystem and the properties provided by such interactions. Management practices that improve soil health and soil quality have gained considerable attention over the past few years, and especially during the past year, as drought conditions have impacted large areas of North America. Vice President of Ag Science at Helier Ag and Chair of Western Region CCA Board of Directors Dr. Carl Wyant explained how soil microbes can be key partners for drought management.
It's interesting talking about drought right now because of the rain everyone's received over the last week or so and cooler conditions, but we really need to keep that drought top of mind for 2022. We're not out of the woods yet, and that's where those microbes come into play. And soil microbes are so critical for drought management. Even though you can't see them, you can't really see what they're doing, you can see the impact on the crop when you go into the height of the season where you have high temperatures and poor water quality or even poor water quantity, which we all experienced back in 2021. So soil microbes help with the first way they help with drought is with restoring soil's physical structure. Microbes release glues, they release sticky substances that help put your soils back together. And when you put your soils back together, you improve the structure, and that allows more water to penetrate into the soil, and it allows more water to infiltrate through the soil column to depth so that you can have more water for later for that crop to use. The other way that microbes help with drought, and this is really something you can't see, is the things that they secrete. When you have a healthy and robust microbial community, you have high abundance, you have high diversity, you have microbes that are secreting osmoprotectants and releasing these signals into the soil to help that plant gear up for drought stress. And that's one of those roles of the osmoprotectants. On the other hand, you have these things they secrete called antioxidants, and these help tie up some of those free radicals and help reduce some of that physical damage that's caused to plants by drought stress.
Soils with healthy microbial populations can restructure and re-aggregate the soil, which leads to better soil structure overall. Good soil structure allows for water, such as snowmelt, rainfall, and irrigation water, to move from the soil's surface or penetrate below the soil surface for storage around and on the soil particles themselves. This results in a number of benefits regarding drought, Wyant said.
That they're so critical. If you go out to your field and your soil looks like dry cake batter that you pull out of a box, maybe you just made some cookies or brownies over the holiday break here. If your soil looks like that, that is sort of a representation of a soil that has poor structure. So poor aggregation, the big organized chunks of soil. And that's what characterizes a healthy soil. Lots of microbes, lots of big aggregates. So when you have a soil that looks like what I just described, big aggregates, you allow that water to actually move into the soil. And that's that penetration piece I mentioned earlier. And when that happens, your soil, your water is no longer moving laterally across your soil. It's actually moving down, and you have to get water down into the soil to store it for later, for when you really need it, especially during a drought. So having those big chunks and having those big those big aggregates of soil that you've stuck together with the glues and tied together with the nets from the microbes, you allow that water to actually move down through these preferential flow pathways, and that allows that water to move with the assistance of gravity into the soil. And then once you get it into the ground, you need to store it for later, and that's where the infiltration piece comes in. When you have good aggregation, you can store water around the pore space, around those aggregates themselves, and in the pore space, so that as a net, your sort of water savings bank account grows. And that's the key to getting through drought.
There are millions and even billions of soil microbes that exist in even a teaspoon of soil, Wyant said. It's still a mystery as to which soil microbes are assisting with drought benefits.
that's still a work in progress about who's doing the work, specifically putting a name on this microbe helps me with my water penetration. That's still a work in progress because of the tremendous diversity that exists below ground, and we just don't know yet. And that's why managing your microbes on a more holistic scale, managing some of them so that, you're when I run this practice on my field, when I do this practice, I tend to get more abundance and more diversity. You're highly likely to get that specific species that does the work of the drought management along for the ride without having to really worry about who's specifically in the field, because chances are we just don't have a good idea yet. And you mentioned that number a million earlier. One thing that's interesting is that if you to go out and you take a scoop, a tablespoon of soil, you'll find a billion bacteria in that single scoop and a million fungi. And so that's this part of this challenge is you have just the sheer number of microbes that you need to manage, in a single tablespoon of soil, just to extract that to to an acre and across depth, down to 3 feet for our permanent crops. So you've got a lot to work with and a lot to consider. But if you just play probabilities, if you're managing them in the correct way, you can really use those probabilities that species that's going to help you with your drought management already lives in your soil, and you can put it to work for you.
A hidden benefit of maintaining a thriving community of microbes during a drought are the substances they secrete. For example, osmoprotectants play a key role in managing challenges with plant water balance under drought conditions. In another example, antioxidants help mitigate oxidative stress and internal plant cell damage observed under drought stress. Studies show that when a robust microbial community releases certain substances below ground, a crop is better able to weather the stress of drought, for example, low rainfall, higher temperatures, more successfully above ground.
You have two basic groups of microbes in the soil. You have bacteria and you have the fungi. So they're very different in terms of like their taxonomic relationship. One's a prokaryote, one's a eukaryote. You learn all about that in your biology 101 class. But interestingly, they're very different, but they do similar things in the soil. And one is those substances they secrete. Bacteria secrete a substance called EPS. It's this extracellular material. There's a longer name for it, extracellular polymeric substances. So that's a long name, so most folks just call it EPS. Just think of it as a glue that bacteria are secreting. And so they secrete it to protect themselves, to make their growing environment better in the soil. But as a benefit, it helps the soil because it sticks particles together like a glue. On the other hand, fungi also secrete a sticky substance. And there's a whole bunch of names for these substances. But fungi do the same thing. They secrete these substances. And it's protein-like. And it's called glomalin in the literature, but it helps to stick particles together. The other thing that fungi do that's very different from bacteria is fungi produce these millions of miles of nets below ground called hyphae. And it's just part of their day-to-day life. Just they make these thread-like structures that go all through the soil, wind up, they wind down, they wind side to side. If you add it all up, it's like a couple million miles in a field worth of this stuff called hyphae. But that acts as like a think of a big shoelace that's tying your soil particles together. And so you have the glues and then you have the nets. So glues and nets, that's the basic two basic properties of how microbes impact soil structure.
Wyant also iterated the fact that testing for your soil microbiology is important to know if they're actually doing their job or if they even exist in the first place. Tests are commonly used to measure chemical and physical constituents of the soil. However, these tests do not determine how really alive the soil is. You can accomplish this goal with a broad set of soil tests that target the living components of soil. Soil biology tests are diverse and include measurements of carbon dioxide respiration, extraction of DNA for microbial community analysis, and other key metrics depending on what parameter you're interested in measuring and your patience level to see a measurable change. Additionally, testing for these microbial components now before the season kicks into gear is of utmost importance.
The fungi and bacteria will just start to why thinking about your soil health now is much better than thinking about it, you know, in July when you really are maybe suffering from some drought impact. Maybe your fields aren't taking water. You can't get watered down. It's because you're dealing with a living entity, the biology of the field, you need time on your side. So the earlier you can start waking up that soil microbial population, the bacteria and fungi, and managing them in a way that helps you have benefits on your field, the sooner you're going to see the impacts of that approach down the road when you really need it. So it's not sort of a last minute, you know, thing that you can do. It really takes time. And that's where the spring season comes into play. If you want to have good microbes and good structure in the summer, you've got to really think about that springtime management strategy, or even that fall management strategy if you want to pull more water into your soil when you do get winter rain. So it's an approach that's a little bit different just because it takes a little bit of time. But there's lots of ways to get involved. There's articles we've put out in the past in Progressive Crop Consultant and West Coast Nut, where it just shows, you know, these microbial populations can be managed. You can add a food source, feed the microbes, wake them up out of dormancy. You can add inoculants, add microbes to your soil. You can use compost and manures. You can use cover crops. Any way that helps feed these microbes, gives them the food they need, and helps them, helps you boost their abundance and diversity. And so one question that comes up is, hey, I've added food source to my program. I've added an approach that directly targets the biology of the field. How do I measure it? And because we love measuring things in ag. And that's where there's been some discussion in the field. And I think this is a great way to bring in a certified crop advisor. If these tests are new to you, really get some help reduce that learning curve, help it with the interpretation of the numbers, and help set some actionable goals. So a certified crop advisor can say, hey, these are the available soil health tests that measure biology. Here's when we should sample, here's where we should sample, and here's what those results mean to help guide your management program.
The microbial community is just one aspect of the greater soil web, and it can't work unless everything else is in tandem. Wyatt said growers have gotten down some of the chemical aspects and nutritional aspects of their soils, but biology has yet to be mastered.
The biology of the field is usually that new frontier of management for a lot of our growers and our certified crop advisors. We've done a great job with the physical management of soils. We've done a great job with chemical management of our soils. And this biology remains really that last lever to pull. And that's the new lever to pull for a lot of people. And so just understanding expectations, how long it takes. We mentioned, applying food sources in the spring to see an impact in the summer. You know, there is a time element here. It's not overnight. So it's a little bit more of a proactive approach as opposed to a reactive approach. But there's lots of great resources out there, including the article we just published here on how soil microbes help with drought management. You know, just looking at how to test it, how to measure it, how to see if your program is doing the job that you need it to do.
Regional and national agricultural news coming up right after this break. The Musco Family Olive Company is leading the transformation of the table olive industry. We are committed to the California olive grower and invite you to grow with our family. Modern table olive orchards apply newly perfected state-of-the-art planting and harvesting to one of the world's oldest tree crops for proven superior results. There is opportunity in any crop transition, and Musco is proud to offer long-term contracts and free trees to our grower partners. Visit us at the Agro Malora booth at the upcoming Calusa Farm Show and the World Ag Expo. See you there. In regional agricultural news here today, according to the CBS8.com website, California Governor Gavin Newsom has signed off on 770 new bills last legislative session. One of those bills is a new workplace law, AB 701. It's a bill that proposes a series of provisions designed to ensure that the use of job performance quotas at large warehouse facilities does not penalize workers for complying with health and safety standards or taking meal and rest breaks. The bill would provide provide that an employee is not required to meet the quota that prevents compliance with meal or rest periods, use of bathroom facilities, or occupational health and safety laws as specified. The bill would prohibit an employer from taking adverse action against an employee for failure to meet a quota that has not been disclosed. The bill would require the Labor Commissioner to enforce these provisions. Assemblymember Lorena Gonzalez, a Democrat from San Diego and author of the bill, said it's unacceptable for the largest and wealthiest employers in the country to put workers' body and lives at risk so consumers can get next-day delivery. She agrees the bill is needed because it would strengthen warehouse workers' rights against arbitrary and an abusive work quota system. The California Chamber of Commerce, in opposition, argues that the bill will create a new private right of action based on vague standards. And according to the California Walnut Board, retail programs drove sales and consumption during seasonal time periods when walnuts are not typically a priority for consumers. For example, during American Heart Month in February, the CWB worked with retailers nationwide on a campaign to display walnuts with messaging about their heart health benefits. With 34 participating retailers operating 10,400 locations, retailers saw an average sales lift of 22.5%. Additionally, television and radio advertising during this program reached 52% of U.S. households. In another example, in May through August of last year, a summer snacking campaign signed on 26 retailers with 7,400 locations to execute in-store promotions and specials. The first-of-its-kind snacking-focused program encouraged retailers to think of new ways to promote walnuts by tying into the consumer trend. Retail elements were supported with consumer outreach, and the average U.S. consumer saw the message on walnuts and snacking 6 times. The campaign drove year-over-year walnut sales increases when compared to the summer months. Lincoln, California police officer Brett Schneider is the winner of the California Farm Bureau Photography Contest. His photo is a close-up of a powerful bull processed into black and white. Schneider's photography skills earned him the grand prize of $1,000 in the 40th annual California Farm Bureau Photo Contest. Let your bees carry a beneficial biofungicide directly to flowers and reduce brown rot, blossom blight, and jacket rot. Sign up for a field trial of bee vectoring and the biofungicide Vectorite with CR7 on your almond orchard. Deadline is January 15th for setup and use at the start of your February bloom. Email contact at beevt.com.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
In National Ag News, if you are a producer or handler of agricultural commodities that are certified organic or are transitioning your operation to certified organic, you may be eligible for financial assistance to cover expenses paid during the 2020, 2021, and 2022 fiscal years through USDA's Organic and Transitional Educational and Certification Program. This new program is part of USDA's Pandemic Assistance for Producers Initiative. USDA's Farm Service Agency will accept applications for fiscal years 2020 and 2021 now through February 4th. That is an extension from the original sign-up deadline, which was January 7th. The application period for fiscal year 2022 applications will be announced at a later date. With the close of 2021, the price of oil is rallying. Patrick DeHaan with GasBuddy.com notes that West Texas crude was trading up roughly $2 a barrel in recent action. He says that's $14 per barrel higher than the start of December when Omicron fears started to impact investors. But he says many of those fears and concerns that investors had to start the month has disappeared.
We continue to see things easing up. More studies indicating that Omicron is less severe than the Delta strain. And so I think markets are closing out the year in rally mode, and we are likely to see gas prices start to inch up in the weeks ahead, as well as diesel, with oil prices leading the way.
DeHaan says unless another more deadly variant is discovered, he expects oil prices to continue this rally into January and perhaps into February.
Globally, we continue to recover. We continue to move beyond, or we continue to see the start of the pandemic moving back in our rearview, meaning that we have more experience under our belt. So I do expect that 2022 will again feature relatively high prices as we continue to see an imbalance between very strong demand and weaker supply.
More information is available at gasbuddy.com. And most farm commodities showed price strength during November. Gary Crawford has the report.
USDA just out with its Farm Price Index report covering November's activities, a report showing price increases for almost every major farm product except one. Overall, farmers seeing price hikes averaging just under 2% in November, putting prices 17% above November of 2020. Checking specific commodities, corn gaining 25 cents during November, averaging $5.27 a bushel, almost a dollar and a half more than a year ago. Wheat grabbing another 61 cents in November to $8.51. That's $3.27 higher than a year ago. Soybeans, 30 cents stronger in November at $12.20 a bushel, $1.90 higher than last year. Livestock, beef cattle gaining $6 in November to average $22 more than November 2020. Prices also rising for broilers and dairy. One exception to all of this, hogs. They dropped almost $7 during November, but still averaging $6.70 a hundredweight higher than this time a year ago. One downside, farmers in November had to pay 8% more than last year for what they needed to do business. Biggest hikes, fertilizer and feed. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The American Farm Bureau Federation's annual meeting takes place starting next Friday in Atlanta, Georgia. If you are not able to make it, there are other options. Chad Smith has the story.
The American Farm Bureau's annual meeting is January 7th through the 12th in Atlanta. However, if your schedule doesn't allow you to get to Georgia in time, Nikki Jones, Director of Events Marketing with IDEA Ag, talks about virtual attendance.
Virtual convention attendees will get to experience most of the convention activities right along with the in-person attendees. There are 10 of the educational sessions that are being live streamed on the virtual platform. Virtual attendees can catch topics such as public policy town hall, influencing and advocating, trade in American agriculture, or top issues facing agriculture from the ag media. Attendees can ask questions of the speakers via the chat function in the platform and have their questions answered live.
The opportunities don't stop there.
They can also experience the lights, sounds, and messages from the general session stage, cheer on their states in the competitions, and catch each of the three keynote addresses live also. Attendees can also check out the short TED-style talk happening on the Cultivation Center stage on the trade show floor. They can get information on topics such as H2A, livestock supply chain, and the drought. To catch the full schedule of events, visit the annualconvention.fb.org website and find the live virtual convention under the Special Events and Experiences page of the website.
Virtual events will still be available for a limited time after the convention ends.
Most of the content is available for 90 days following the event. So if an attendee is unable to catch a specific session live, they can go back and view it or take notes or rewatch topics of interest. Virtual only registration is $25, and the registration link can be found on the website at annualconvention.fb.org.
Chad Smith, Washington.
Information on the renewable fuels industry with USDA Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack right after this.
Being a member of the California walnut industry means working together to advance the industry through advocacy, research programs, and promoting walnuts with smart, cost-effective marketing. Learn more at walnuts.org.
Questions remain when it comes to blending fuels in the biofuels industry. U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack talks about what he is doing to represent producers in this discussion.
Well, I've worked very closely with Administrator Reagan, first and foremost, to reinforce the importance of the EPA providing some stability in the program. And I think that is reflected in the fact that the administrator has indicated that he is not going to be granting the waivers in quite the same way that the Trump administration granted them, that created really instability in the program. While numbers could be announced, when waivers were granted, it basically undercut the numbers that were announced, the volume numbers. I fully expect and anticipate in the very near future the EPA will announce those standards. And I think what's important is that they will likely also respond to the outstanding waiver requests that are currently indicating consistency with maintaining stability in the program. We look forward when those announcements are made to also be able to provide more details on the distribution of $700 million of assistance and help that we've already identified and earmarked, if you will, for the biofuel industry. Congress did not provide that level of assistance or help when they passed pandemic assistance earlier this year, or for that matter, during the Trump administration. We're making the decision to provide this assistance. And we're looking forward to the Build Back Better investment, where the president and Democrats have provided and identified roughly $1 billion of additional assistance for the industry. And also, we will continue to look for ways in which we can expand higher blends, as we're announcing today, with the $3 million that will effectively help folks in 9 states be able to access higher blends. So I think if you look at the overall effort here, I think you're going to see consistent support for the RFS, as well as the opportunity that was announced several months ago for the development of a new biofuel industry for aviation fuel, which is an exciting new opportunity, which over time could create a $35 billion, 100% drop-in aviation fuel that will also be a great asset to the biofuel industry.
USDA Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. Stay tuned for information from the California Strawberry Commission right after this quick break.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Once again, this is Lori Boyer, and joining me now here on the show is Chris Christian. She is the Senior Vice President of the California Strawberry Commission. We'll talk about different things that the commission does, but before we get started, Chris, tell me a little bit more about yourself and your background.
Yes, thanks, Lori, and I'm happy to be here with you today. I have been in the food and agricultural industry for over 25 years now, mostly working in California specialty crops. I'm actually a food scientist by training who got her start in the fresh cut produce industry. And I've been with the California Strawberry Commission now for about 19 years.
Do you yourself have a background in agriculture? Did you grow up in the industry?
I grew up in Western Pennsylvania in a rural area on a very small family farm. We were not a commercial farm at all. We were just a family farm who grew for ourselves and sold a little bit at the roadside. But I grew up around farming, different scales, and then got interested again in agriculture after completing my undergraduate work at Penn State University. I went back and went for a master's in food science, and that's what led me into working with specialty crops in Pennsylvania, and then eventually to specialty crops in California.
Okay, thank you for that. The Strawberry Commission, the California Strawberry Commission, where are you headquartered at?
Our headquarters for the California Strawberry Commission is in Watsonville, California. We also have offices in our various production districts in Ventura, in Santa Maria, and we also have an office up in Sacramento.
Okay. And just educate me a little bit more, I guess, if you will. Tell me about the strawberry industry in California, a little bit more about how big it is, what kind of members you have, maybe where is it consolidated to one area of the state, just some general info.
Oh, sure. So here at the California Strawberry Commission, we represent all of the growers, shippers, and processors of strawberries here in California. We produce strawberries on over 35,000 acres, mostly along the Central Coast. So our primary production area is from all the way from San Diego County, north through Ventura, Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, Monterey, and Santa Cruz. Those are our primary production districts for strawberries in the state. And the reason we grow in those areas is because of the unique coastal climate and the moderating effect of that climate, which is the ideal climate in the world for growing strawberries, which we have right here in California. Our members include about 300 family farmers. Many of them are multi-generational family farmers. And about two-thirds of our farmers are descended from immigrants, Mexican-American immigrants.
Do most of the strawberries stay in the United States, or do you export a lot of them?
Most of our production does stay within the United States and North America. Our exports are about 17 or 18% of our overall fresh and frozen production. And that primarily goes to North America, so to Canada and Mexico. Canada is our largest export market, followed by Mexico. We also export strawberries to Asia, various Asian markets, and then some to Europe and to the Middle East as an industry.
Chris, is it a high labor intensive crop, or is there technology that is developed to help harvest the strawberries?
Strawberries remain a very labor intensive crop. We employ probably about 50,000 farm workers. Strawberries have to be hand harvested. They are individually picked and placed into the clamshell containers that everyone sees in the stores. And that berry is not touched again until the shopper opens it up at home. So we have a big focus around education on the farms with respect to food safety and grower and worker education as well.
Are a lot of the workers migrant workers?
Some are migrant, yes. Some follow the crop throughout the state. We have many, many workers in our industry who return each year and work for the same farming companies year after year. We have many stories from our industry of farm workers who find their way to the American dream, starting out in the strawberry fields, and have now become farm owners and employers themselves.
Chris Christian, Senior Vice President of the California Strawberry Commission, and I'll have more with her coming up in a future episode.
And that will conclude today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily Newscast. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. From all of us at the JCS Marketing Team, thank you for listening.